With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Welcome. 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 Welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Willkommen, bienvenue, welcome to the Dirk Pohlman Show from Berlin, Germany. My guest today is Ola Fridtjofsson. Hi, Ola.
Hi, Dirk. Nice to hear from you again.
Ola is a former political appointee working for several social democratic Swedish governments in the late 80s and 90s. He was also the former leader of international affairs in the youth organization of the Swedish Social Democrats. In that position, he traveled to Nicaragua, where Olof Palme was in high esteem, and to Poland to help Solidarność, the Polish Union Fighting for Democracy, at the end of the Cold War era, really. Olaf Rutjofsson's social democratic lineage is important in this interview, too. His father was Undersecretary of Defense in Sweden, and he told his sons confidentially early on in the 80s, the submarines violating Swedish waters at that time regularly and made Olof Palme's detente policy impossible, were not Soviet, but Western. The military and the media told the Swedes they were Soviet. So while Palme developed his detente policy, the Soviets apparently backstepped him by violating Swedish waters. That's what 99% of the Swedish population thought, and most politicians. We know better today, but we does not mean 99% of the Swedish population today. Right, Ola?
That is correct. The mainstream picture is that we really don't know who was here, but many Swedes still believe it was the Soviets.
Yeah, I shopped a little bit around and I noticed we have to explain really from scratch. We have been talking about these things quite often, but the audience might not even know who Olof Palme was. So might I ask you to give a short, concise introduction into the topic of Olof Palme and the Swedish submarine affair?
Okay. Olof Palme was a Swedish prime minister from 68 till his death in 86. He was born in the 1920s, 29, I believe, and he became Social Democrat around 1948. He was from the nobility, the upper classes in Sweden, and he turned Social Democrat. He formed a policy that was contrary to United States interests, you could say. He formed a group, Six Nation Initiative, in the late 70s while he was in opposition, and it contained countries like India, also people from the Soviet Union and others. And they formulated a program. They called for common security. We have to change from confrontation to common security, finding security together among nations and not against nations. And you could say in that way he fulfilled what Willy Brandt and Egon Bahr in Germany started in the 60s, I believe, and late 60s. And he wanted dialogue with the East, with the Warsaw Pact, with the Soviet bloc. He wanted, exchange in various fields of society. He wanted to find common ground, you could say. And that was not liked in many circles, especially in the United States and within the NATO organization. And they felt that he was kind of a threat to their agendas, and things started to happen. Suddenly there was a Soviet submarine on Swedish rocks close to the big naval base in southern Sweden, and it was almost on shore. We couldn't explain. People thought Soviet personnel on board were drunk, or there were different solutions to why they were there, but it's obvious It was a psychological operation. It was the first event that we had to take to our to see as our right reality. Our reality was distorted. Our reality was not the true reality. We thought it was a Soviet submarine that went there because the Soviets were very mean to us and so on. In fact, I believe, and many with me believe, that this first submarine also was part of this psychological operation aimed against the Swedish opinion, the Swedish media, the Swedish politicians, and the Swedish military. And from there, 1982, things started happening in the Stockholm archipelago, just in the another naval base outside of Stockholm. People saw what they thought were submarine parts of submarines, at the surface. They didn't see it very good. And there was a submarine hunt started. And I think it was some around 46 bombs were dropped from boats at the surface down below to where they thought the submarines were. And I believe several submarines were hurt, damaged, at least two. They were also using mines. First time since World War II, there were mines used in Swedish waters. And this was also very exceptional. You know, first this submarine running aground in the close to the naval base in the southern parts of Sweden, 1981. And then 1982, this submarine hunt in 1982 in October, just as we were shifting governments from a right government on the right and to the Social Democratic government. And from there, you could say that the Swedish opinion transformed radically. Almost all of us thought that, including myself, thought that this was Soviet submarines and that we were under attack of some sort. We wondered what were they doing? Were they planning for war or what? We were told but that they were planning for war from our military and from military abroad, like the United States military. And Olof Palme's ambitions to form, when he now started the Social Democratic government, 1982, after a period of this right governments to the right in politics, he could not fulfill his political goals. He could not carry out the security policy he wanted. It was impossible to him to talk to the Soviets when they were supposed, we believed they were in our waters attacking us. So he had to put that aside and he had to protest to them, call them Soviet ambassador to the Foreign Office and so on, and talk to him, and they call it the diplomatic note sent to Moscow and so on. And from there it deteriorated. These submarine incursions, they continued. There were reports every year until Olof Palme was murdered in February 1986. On the streets of Stockholm. He was shot down. He was shot close range in the back, fell dead to the ground. He was walking with his wife, Lisbeth, and she was also shot upon, but she didn't, her wound was not serious, and she survived. And from there, another story developed, another Sweden developed, another security policy developed, and it was all much more in line with American interests than the policy before.
Yeah, I think we have to also say that the Olof Palme murder is something like the JFK story in the United States. The official version was that it is a lone gunman who did it, an alcoholic in the beginning, who was sentenced first, but then had to retract the judgment. And Since then, it is a conundrum. What? Who did it? What happened? And I would say everybody who wants to know knows that this is in a the murder happened in a situation where parts of the Swedish security elite were openly discussing to kill Palme because he was considered a traitor. But we get into that now. First, I would like to ask, I mentioned that your father, who was inside the Swedish military, let's say that connects between politics and military, he, what did he tell you, you and your brother, and when did he tell you that?
Well, yes, he was Undersecretary of Defense for close to 10 years. And before that, he worked at the Ministry of Finance with a budget, a defense budget. So more than a decade, he was connected to the Swedish defense system. And he knew a lot. He knew about the war planning. He knew about, you know, the material, weapons and systems and everything that we had and the planning. And he told me in late 1983, about a year after the first submarine incursions in 82, where those bombs were dropped, that this was submarines from the West, he said. And so I was very surprised. He didn't want to say anything more. I still remember the picture, you know, we were living in a house where he took me aside to the library and his home office, and he told me this between four eyes, so to say, and he didn't answer any questions. And then after some years, he said about the same to my brother. But I know you from Germany, Dirk, and actually told my brother it was German submarines. And this is, you know, we don't know why my father, I don't know why my father said this to me. I know he wanted me to get some kind of truth, that he didn't want me to be fooled, because at that time I had a quite important position in the Social Democratic Youth organization, working with security policy, international policy. And we were, of course, the big party. We had around 45% of the electoral vote at that time. And we governed together with the left party, the former Communist Party. They were not in the government, but they were supporting us. And so he wanted me to get the real understanding, I think. But I don't know what he knew, what information he had. He had, of course, connections to the top brass of the Swedish military. He was close friend to the, you could say, Joint Chiefs of Staff, the one heading that, the Swedish general heading all the defense systems, and he might have told my father some things, and he also knew about the war planning. And when he mentioned it was German submarines, that could have to do with the war planning, because in a war against the Warsaw Pact, Sweden was non-aligned in peacetime, and we aimed at neutrality during wartime. But if we were to be attacked, we would defend ourselves. And of course, if we defend ourselves in the Baltic against Soviet Warsaw Pact submarines, we didn't want to shoot down any Danish or German, West German submarines at the time. So there had to be some coordination. The Germans had some responsibility in some areas and the Swedes in other areas and so on. And the German submarines had to find refuge in Swedish archipelagos because the German coast was very open and vulnerable. So there was even an article written by a Swedish commander, submarine commander Britselius. He wrote the just before all this started in 82 or 81, I think, in the internal magazine for the Navy people, that there was a European road on water for the West German submarines going from Karlskrona, the southern naval base, up through the Swedish archipelago and through Stockholm archipelago and over to the Finnish archipelago, more or less, and so it was insiders that wrote this, and I guess, you know, that could have been the source. But anyhow, he told me this was not Soviet submarines and this was West. For me, that was kind of a watershed moment, you know, when you standing looking at the reality, you have a belief system and suddenly it's taken away from you. And I had to reconsider a lot of my how I viewed the world and the Swedish political and security system. And that was gradually, you know, I didn't have that immediate impact, but it was something that formed my personality and my personal beliefs. And I actually stopped, I quit being the international secretary for this youth organization in 84. And I started my university studies, and then I returned in government, but I work with totally different aspects of politics. I work with regional development, with tourism, with industrial research and those kind of things. And I had nothing to do with security policy, international policy. I didn't want to, but I felt uncertain. What could I believe? What could I? And then gradually I've gotten an understanding of the world that is kind of different from many of my party comrades and my fellow comrades in my relatives and my friends and so on, and what is written in mainstream media is not my view any longer. So
I want to wrap up something so that the audience will understand it, because it's European matters and it's a long time ago. So Olof Palme, when he governed Sweden, it was the most important and strongest social democratic party in the world. And Sweden had an importance that was far above its, let's say, regional or national ranking in any kind of scale. It was kind of a moral superpower, because Palme, even in the communist bloc, I remember, for example, in East Germany, there were Palme marches. It was a possible connection to the West. Palme stood for a peace policy, and you mentioned the common security policy, which was formulated by the German physicist Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker, by Egon Bahr, and by Willy Brandt. And they basically said, in a nuclear war, nobody can win. So there is a common interest, and it's not possible, like in former times, that you win a war. So it's a common strategy to avoid it. And for that, you have to do collaboration. And that was what happened. And also Palme, to give an idea, he was in very high esteem in South America, for example, in Nicaragua, where you've been. Also in Cuba, I remember I saw the TV footage when he came to Cuba. There was a huge, like in the communist era, a huge portrait of him hanging there. Welcome, Staatsminister Palme. And he was very much in favor of the resistance movements, the Palestinians. He supported them, and African National Congress, ANC, Nelson Mandela, was single-handedly supported by Palme and the Soviet Union. And this combination did not go down well with the Americans. He protested against the Vietnam War. So he was kind of the speaker, I would say, of the bloc-free world. And he was a voice that had an enormous resonating in the world. So that is why Palme was so important. And that is why it was important that he was killed. And in this, when he came to power, what immediately happened, what you described, were these submarines coming, and they made the policy he wanted to make. His foreign policy was impossible, because he all the time had to prove that he was not aligned with the Russians. In a way, you could say similar, like Trump had to prove after 2016, he was attacked of being a Russian stooge. And that's a similar situation. Palme always had to make sure that he was protesting. And I want to tell one little story. I interviewed the former ambassador of the Soviet Union in Sweden, and he said he related to the Swedish government. The Soviets didn't understand what was going on. They were not very educated in terms of info wars in the media. So their ambassador said to later on, I think in the mid-80s, he told the Swedish government on behalf of the Soviet government, please attack the submarines and destroy them, because they are not ours. You will see when you bring them up that it won't be Soviet submarines. It's from somewhere else. But that's my next question. I'm moving towards that. That was not really published in the media. The public perception was it's the Soviet, and everybody thought that. Everybody that I talked to said in the beginning, I thought it was the Soviets. For most of the people, it carried on. But when your father told that, was there a discussion that it couldn't be Soviets? I mean, there's the case of the Swedish defense minister, maybe you can tell that, who had to resign because he started to talk about the possibility it could not be Soviet submarines. It was impossible to talk about it.
Yes, it was the foreign minister, Lennart Bodström, and he was talking privately with some journalists at the dinner. Of course, a foreign minister should realize that he cannot talk privately with journalists if they are not very friendly to him. But he said that you cannot draw the conclusion that just
But excuse me, Ola, maybe we should, because I have to switch to the advertisement, maybe we should start with this story, the very strange story of the demise of Lennart Bodström after the advertisement.
Jesse Zerowell on TNT Radio.
I haven't experienced hyper-reality to this extent at any point in my life.
It's getting worse and worse in a sense. There's a number of distractions going on around us, of course, that point in the wrong direction. You know, they're telling us we should look in a certain direction whilst things are happening somewhere else. You know, in my analysis, in my view, everything really depends on what we call the debt market or the bond market, you know, and bond markets have become very fragile of recent. Obviously, the Bank of England, just a couple of days ago, it had to step in and basically go back to QE, quantitative easing, buying lots of bonds. It used to be the most boring thing ever, you know, just debt market or credit market, bond markets in general were very boring because nothing ever changed. All of a sudden, they've become very unstable. You know, they go up and down very quickly, very rapidly. And I think one sign that things are getting worse is always bond yields going up very rapidly.
Jesse Zerowell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are Opportunity Zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702. Or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
This is the Dirk Pohlman Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And back to Olaf Richardson telling us about the strange story of the Swedish defense minister who had to step back because he even raised the possibility, what we know now, that it was not Soviet submarines. We know it now, but at that time it was not possible to talk about it, that were running back and forth in the Swedish waters in the 80s.
Right. He was the foreign minister, Lennart Bodström, and he had to resign because it was impossible for Olof Palme, the prime minister, to have him in office after he, at a private dinner to some dinner guests, journalists, there were six of them, said that you cannot accuse your neighbor just because the ski tracks goes from the neighbor's yard to your yard garden, so to say. If you imagine small houses situated next to each other and a ski track going from one to another, and that was enough for Palm. He couldn't have keep him because it was everybody thought this was Soviet submarines, and if the foreign minister said something else, even if he didn't say more than he just didn't know who was there, that he couldn't stay in office. We had an committee investigating the submarine incursions in 1982. It was ready with its work. It was completed in I think April in 1983, and they concluded it was most likely. They didn't have proof, but they had circumstantial evidence, they thought, that it was most likely submarines from the Warsaw Pact, and most likely than Soviet. And that was what the Swedes believed. And Lennart Bodström had to step back, and Palme's policy was severely damaged. It was totally damaged by these submarine incursions, and that was the aim. That was the aim with these submarine incursions that actually were conducted under American supervision or with American forces.
So, and I recall there were several instances the military people were sick and tired of having the submarines running around, and they were told by the Swedish High Command to show restraint. But some of the officers didn't want to. And in one occasion, there was a huge mine was exploded and obviously damaged a foreign submarine. There were repair works to be heard by the sonar equipment. And the commander wanted to finish the submarine off. And he was stopped by a communication from the headquarters of the Swedish Navy. It's, I think it never came out who did it. But then he was stopped to throw a whole amount of water bombs to kill off the submarine. He was only allowed to drop one or two, and that was not enough to have an area bombardment, so to speak, where the submarine was sitting on the ground. And it was possible for the submarine to get out. And I saw in the Stasi files here in Berlin, I saw that a report from Sweden that the Swedish officers were furious, and they considered that the traitor Palme made sure that his Soviet buddies were able to retreat from Swedish waters before they could be killed. So that was, because I want to come to that, the Swedish submarine crisis on the one hand made the policies of Palme impossible, but it also led to a situation where people in the Swedish military and in the security apparatus and the intelligence services and the SEPO, which is internal security police in Sweden, thought that Sweden was a traitor. And there was more evidence presented to them. Maybe you can talk about that. You wrote a very interesting article about it, which has been published, unfortunately, only in Sweden in Swedish. But I'd like you to get into a bit of this information you have in that article.
Yeah. Well, the submarine incursions, people thought they were Soviet, and Palme was named a traitor in media, by professors in academia, by politicians, and especially by right-wing, radical right or fascist police and military people. And it was, as you said, believed that he let the Soviet submarine out through this incident you mentioned. That was the rumor. And that was, it was like putting fertilizer on a growing crop. They they went mad, some police and security police and military people.
And to make sure that people understand, it was not Palmer who let the submarine out. It was, astonishingly enough, it was, who was it? Or not who? We don't know for sure who, but we know where the order came from.
If you read, like you had, you interviewed Ola Thunander, the professor in Peace Research Institute Oslo earlier, and he has written about this extensively, and he has also given some leads to names. I really don't want to name names. I don't know, but it's evident that a submarine was let out. It was damaged, and it was believed to be Palme that let it out, but he had nothing to do with it. Actually, he wanted them to stop the submarines. He cleared the use of mines, very, very heavy mines that would really destroy everything in nearby, so he did not stop anything, because also he at this time, I believe, thought it was Soviet submarines, and he wouldn't have wanted to use so much force if he thought it was German or American subs. And of course, this Ola Thunander, he described this, he was small Italian midget submarines and with American crew on board. And to get this story right, I think you have to go back in history to this military people working with Stay Behind. And there was a Swedish Stay Behind formed already during the last days of the Second World War and just after. And it was a totally Swedish initiative from military, from industry, from trade unions, from politicians, the parliamentary system. And it was with British interests involved. And it was formed during an old prime minister called Per Albin Hansson, who was prime minister during the war, and he died shortly after. But then, this was 1946, but then in 1952, the CIA director to be and phonics program in Vietnam responsible to be, William Colby, headed the CIA station at the American Embassy in Stockholm. And during his stay there in 1952, he tried to form a new American-controlled Stay Behind. And he did that in other countries as well, in the Nordic countries. And I have no direct access to these people, but I have spoken to people that have direct access. And they said to me that it was not well thought of among the original Stay Behind people, this initiative, this American initiative. And they also say that he didn't succeed completely. He didn't manage to get rid of the Swedish. So my picture is that there were some disturbances, there was some confusion, that we had, in fact, two Stay Behinds, and perhaps those that were organizing these activities didn't really know who was what. But some people within Stay Behind from 1952 did not only answer to the Swedish system, but answered also to the American system. And in the 70s, we had a foreign minister and a politician, a social democrat called Sten Andersson, who was known for his black humor. And he said once to a person close to him working at the Foreign Office that the Swedish security police, parts of it revolted against their own government in the 1970s, and it was not better in the 1980s. And of course, they were revolting in the 70s and it was not better in the 80s, you can try to understand what happened. And the head of this security police organization, he was forced to resign in the early 70s, late 60s. And because he was talking about Olof Palme as a security issue, he was not to be relied upon, the new prime minister. And of course, this goes back to Olof Palme's activities. He was against the war in Vietnam. He was pro-Palestinian people. He was all those things that you talked about. And it was not very well appreciated among the more right-wing oriented people in the security establishment. And I believe also those that worked closest to the Americans. And of course, we don't know much about this. It's very much secretive, everything. But I tried to analyze this, and I sent my material in 2017, I think, to the murder investigation into the murder of Olof Palme, the police and the prosecutors. And they came back to me after a year. I had sent them more than 100 pages of text and perhaps around 1,000, you know, footnotes. And they told me they had read everything, and that even the footnotes, they have checked the footnotes, and they believed me, my story. And my story is what I'm telling you now about. And so they invited me to a seminar in May 2018 and to talk to them about these matters. And I did. And when I later heard their, you know, finding that they couldn't prosecute anybody because the suspect was dead, and it was this lone killer, this lone nut, again, a second one, the Scandia man, and they call him. He worked at the place, Scandia insurance company, and it was anticlimax for me, as for very many other Swedes. I had really gotten the impression that they thought that the Swedes were being fooled we were fooled in the 1980s. The reality was not what we thought was reality. Reality was a psychological operation, inflicting our minds, our understanding of things. And it was not Soviet submarines, it was American. And then I draw comparisons to the strategy of tension in Italy in the 60s and 70s, where bombs were placed at railway stations and squares and buildings, and the blame was put on the far left, the revolutionary left, the anarchists and so on. And in fact, it was the fascists. It was the fascists stay behind that did this. And this has been revealed in court sessions, you know, with judges presiding, and it has also been revealed in documents left when the fascist junta in Portugal had to leave rapidly, and they didn't have time to destroy all documents. So some of them were left for others to read. And of course, the end of this campaign, strategy of tension, was an American-led campaign to blame the left for this violence, and to form another Italy that was more in coherence with American interests. And then Aldo Moro was murdered in 1978, I believe, and he had been just recently
the Italian prime minister.
He had been an Italian prime minister. I think at the time that he was killed, Andreotti was the prime minister, but he had an agenda leaning, you could say, towards what Palme was doing 10 years later, He wanted Italian independence from the Soviets and from the Americans. And of course, Italy was very much an American playground from after the World War. And they did everything.
The base for the Sixth Fleet.
Italy could not be lost, so to say, from American point of view. And it was strategic for them to have Italy in their palms, in their hands. And Aldo Moro wanted to cooperate as a Christian Democrat. He wanted to cooperate with the Eurocommunists. The Eurocommunists in Italy, they were not closely connected to the Soviet system. They were independent. That's why we call them Eurocommunists. And to form a broader political alliance to get more stability, because it was always instability in the political system in Italy, and to get them inside instead of being on the outside. It was also the trade unions that were ruled by Eurocommunist interests. And he carried out this also when he left as prime minister. I guess he did it even more, because then he was in a more free role. And Aldo Moro's wife, Eleonora, I think her name was, has said, and it has been written in mainstream media, that Aldo Moro, shortly before he was murdered, I will get to how he was murdered, but shortly before he was murdered in 1978, Henry Kissinger said to him that he really had to reconsider what he was doing, or otherwise he would pay dearly for it. And there was also
And I think he was even told that there would be physical consequences, that expression. Before we go to the next round of advertisements, I want to wrap up so that people understand. Aldo Moro was a conservative politician. He was a Christian Democrat. So he was not a left-winger, but he wanted to form a coalition with a Communist Party, which in itself was not Moscow. It was an independent left-wing party, which was viewed in Moscow as going astray, being a heretic organization. So Aldo Moro, what he wanted, that was called the historic compromise, compromesso storico in Italian. That was a very important word at that time. So it was, if we work together, because on the other hand, you also have the mafia, which was infiltrated by the Americans in World War II to fight against German occupation, really. And that was after the war, it was very strong. So the possibility to stay away from the mafia was with this part of the conservative party that Aldo Moro was leading, together with the communists. That would have been a chance to get Italy into stable conditions. We leave it there and we get back to the story after the advertisement.
Remember the ozone hole and how we thought we solved the problem? Well, it's back.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
New scientific research has found that a gigantic ozone hole has widened 7 times larger than Antarctica's ozone loss and has accelerated since the early 1980s, despite the 1987 Montreal Protocol to limit CFCs in the atmosphere, or chlorofluorocarbons. Despite the claims of success over limiting the ozone hole, it's back. And this is despite the 1987 Montreal Protocol's ban on ozone-depleting substances. One leading researcher noted that our scientific understanding of chloride chemistry has really been blown apart, as we basically can no longer say we understand how ozone holes come into being. The science is never settled. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio. Thanks for listening.
Emergency, police, fire, ambulance.
Hello?
Yes, police, fire, or ambulance.
It's my friend.
Oh, okay, look, I need you to stay on the phone. Oh, just stay on the phone.
He's getting blown away.
Okay, now hang on. Oh.
000's sole job is to connect you to emergency services. So please, stay on the line and you'll get help faster.
Dirk Pullman on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
And back with a story on Aldo Moro, which is really mind-bending because it's nothing is as it seems. You could say tell it right away. So I was just explaining or wrapping up that Aldo Moro was tried to have this historical compromise as a politics in Italy, and he was told by the American side that this would not be possible. It would not be. It was not acceptable to America because no NATO basis country could be ruled or co-ruled by a communist party, no matter if, how close they were to Moscow or not. They were not close. So please go on from there, Ola.
Yeah, we're talking about this because I see a parallel to the Swedish events, the submarine incursions and so on in the 80s, and this strategy of tension in Italy in the late 60s and early and 70s, and the killing, the murder of Aldo Moro. And Aldo Moro, he wanted more Italian independence, not only from the Americans, but also from the Soviets. He wanted true Italian rule, and that was not acceptable. There was a State Department, I think, assistant under secretary at the time, working in Italy with the Italian government, the Christian Democratic government. Prime Minister was Andreotti, and the Interior Minister was Cossiga. And he was Steve Piechniks or something like that in the
Piechnik.
Piechnik, yeah. And he wrote a book published in the 2000s sometimes, 2007 perhaps, that the head title of the book is We Killed Aldo Moro. This is not a big secret anymore, I think. Of course, they will deny it, but the Americans. But it's told in wide circles. And in 1999, the head of the military intelligence service, who was appointed shortly after the killing of Aldo Moro, Fulvio Martini, he was questioned about this in the Italian parliament, and it was, you know, documented in protocol what he said. What really happened when Aldo Moro was killed was that the Red Brigades in Italy, they kidnapped him and they held
left-wing
him hostage.
Terrorist organization. The Red Brigades
And they held him hostage because they said they wanted to have some of their revolutionary comrades freed from prison. They were serving prison time. And so negotiations started to see if this was possible to exchange Aldo Moro's life for the freeing of these revolutionary comrades to the Red Brigades. And Cossiga was interior minister, and he was heading the negotiations because Andreotti wouldn't want to have anything with this to do. So he didn't want to negotiate at all. And we know that Cossiga was very close to stay behind, and he was also a member of the P2 Lodge. It was discovered later. And there was, you know, the mafia, it was military intelligence, it was people, a secretive organization trying to rule behind the scenes, so to say. Cossiga was part of that. And what has been shown is that the leadership of the Red Brigades, they were taken out in 1974, 4 years before Aldo Moro was murdered. And they were, the new leadership, part of it was the stay behind people, pretending to be Red Brigades. I have been told this also from another source, and Gene Tatum, who we perhaps could talk about later in Iran-Contra
yes,
and so on.
Yes, we need to.
And he was stationed in Italy at the time, but as he told me, he was working mostly in former Yugoslavia, I mean the Balkan countries, I don't know what he did there, but anyhow, he said that at the time there was a medical student, a female, heading the Red Brigades, and she was taken out in some way in 1974, and the leadership from that time was the Italian Stay Behind, which is equal to the Italian fascists at the time. And this Fulvio Martini, the head of the Italian military intelligence service, he told the Italian parliamentarians in 1999, and this is to be read from protocol, that the first thing he did when he got his new office was to go up to the American embassy and tell them that he never again wanted to see Michael Ledeen set his foot in Italy again. And the reason for this was that he worked too close to Interior Minister Cossiga heading these negotiations. That, of course,
I think you again
succeed.
Have to explain. Michael Ledeen is also a gray eminence of the
American
policy.
Yeah, the Michael Ledeen, he was an advisor to different American Republican politicians. He is, I would say, a fascist ideologue. And he has worked with think tanks such as this, different Washington think tanks, and he has had an influence over American politics in decades from behind the scenes.
I think he wrote his doctor's thesis about fascism, isn't it? Certain ways an admirer of fascism. So when you'd call him a fascist, that's the reason why, to explain it. Yeah.
Yeah. He was working too close to Cossiga. The result of the negotiations were that no Red Brigade prisoners were released, and Aldo Moro was shot dead in military fashion. And his body was found in the trunk of a car. And his wife said that I don't want to have any Italian or other official representation at the funeral, because she knew what had happened.
And it's also, I would like to add a small detail, that the body, the car with the body of Aldo Moro, was positioned exactly halfway between the headquarters of the Democrazia Cristiana, the Conservative Party, and the Communist Party. So that was why would the Red Brigade do that. And to another very short story is when the Red Brigades in the mid-70s, they noticed that there was a mole in their ranks, and they wanted to have a meeting with the four highest persons of the Red Brigades to discuss this problem of the mole. And when they met, there were only three of them. The fourth one was missing. And the three of them were picked up by the police. And the fourth one then became the head of the Red Brigades. And he is considered an agent, an intelligence agent by now.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Red Brigades were infiltrated, as were other left-wing groups. And also this strategy of tension was carried out by pure fascists and with weapons from American stockpiles in West Germany, and in cooperation with a commodore from the naval base in Verona in Italy. And this is all proven. This has been said by generals and so on in the Italian system. And he didn't want Ledeen to set his foot in Italy again, and also he said that Ledeen had gotten money in an account in a bank in the West Indies, around $100,000 at the time, a big amount of money, tax-free, I guess, for his services. And he was asked about stay behind, and he said that okay, Cossiga knew about stay behind, but the former prime minister Aldo Moro, he knew nothing about stay behind. So the prime minister knew nothing about what the interior minister was a very central figure for. That says something also about how this works. The power is not always where you think it is. It's somewhere else. And I think there were also other things that were interesting in this protocol. Fulvio Martini spells it out. Quite frank way, and in 1999, it's there for everybody that can read some Italian to read. And it's very interesting, I think. So
We are on the hour. We have to get back. So in the next hour, we'll talk how this connects to Sweden, because this thesis in your paper, and it's well documented, is that if you don't understand the stay behind network system, you do not understand the Olof Palme murder. We get to that after the news of the hour.